You've tuned in to the First Few Moments podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The First Few Moments podcast is the most up-to-date source for responder best practice discussions and incident review. Join industry leaders and seasoned providers at firstfewmoments.com. You can talk to us through Twitter at First Few Moments, email us at podcast@firstfewmoments.com, or call us at 716-245-5FFM. Hello, welcome everyone to First Few Moments, your bi-weekly podcast about managing your scene, where we discuss safety management, triage, and care. I'm your host, Kyle David Bates, and folks, we are going to have a great episode tonight. And yes, it's not a repeat, but it's a topic that we've brought up quite a bit. And, you know, I hate to beat these dead horses, but if you follow First Few Moments on Twitter, we have a Twit feed set up that searches the internet, scours the internet for anything that deals with ambulance crashes or ambulance accidents. And it seems like every other day there is an article or a news report about an ambulance crashing somewhere, especially in the United States. We've seen a lot of these crashes. Some have just been injury accidents. Some have actually been fatalities. And I'm starting to wonder why we're getting these. And, you know, I hate to rehash this, but I think it's needed because we are crashing so many emergency vehicles out there every day. Matter of fact, a recent study showed between 2003-2009, almost 1,300 U.S. workers died on roadway crashes each year. And this is ridiculous. In 2002, field investigations estimated that a fatality rate for EMS workers was more than two times the national average for all workers. Folks, this is ridiculous. Now, you can sit there and start to dissect. Maybe that has something to do with the flight medicine of things. But, you know, it's still a lot of injuries. And it's a lot of fatalities that is inexcusable because a lot of these can be prevented. So we're going to kind of talk about some articles that I was sent earlier this morning. So first of all, to help us talk about this is William Random Ward. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Good, good. How are things down there in Baltimore?
Baltimore's good. It's a very nice night. I went out, had a nice walk. It's been a good couple of days. Yeah, otherwise things are doing great here.
Great. Well, I'm glad to have you on. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Next is Robert Rahab. How are you?
Good, Kyle. How are you?
I am great. So how are things out there? And you were giving us a lesson earlier today of how to say this, Long Island.
That's right, Long Island.
Long Island. How you doing?
Good. We're doing good out here.
Excellent.
Yeah, things are going well. The beautiful weather. And it's actually cooled down a little bit, and the humidity's dropped tremendously, which is always a nice break.
Yeah, it's dropped here, which has been, thank goodness, because it's been absolutely horrible. We get that humidity off the lake here, and it's like 93% humidity and 90 degrees for the last few days. So
yeah.
I feel for you there. You got the whole ocean. We just have a small little lake over here. Well, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
And the third person on my panel tonight is my partner in crime in the First Few Moments project, Mr. Steve Murphy. Steve, how are you?
Oh, very good tonight, Kyle. How's everybody else? Well, I know how the other two are. How are you?
I am doing good. Doing good. The baby is sleeping. The baby's doing well. You know,
sleeping now or sleeping all night?
Sleeping pretty much all night, which is nice.
Really? You know what that means, if a baby sleeps all night?
I'm afraid to ask.
Parents are sound sleepers.
My wife isn't, see, I never heard her. All right, well, Steve, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You know, so we were just kind of talking about some statistics there, but Steve, you actually sent me an article earlier this morning that kind of prompted my idea of what we're going to talk about. Why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit of an overview of that?
All right, just, you know, looking around today, some of the places I visit to get some information, and Emergency Management News ran an article or made reference to an article that was published on govtech.com. And basically the overview of the article is using technology to make emergency response safer for firefighters, EMS, and police. So I went through and I looked at the article, of course, always looking for things that may help out here in our county with our responders. And a lot of technology-based solutions or proposed solutions, but I kept coming back to I'm not certain that technology is the answer to making responses safer. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit about that article tonight, and I know you've got the link to it, so if anybody's interested, they can get that from the website. But I'd like to hear what everybody has to say about the use of technology in improving responses and making them safer.
Hey, Steve, just for those people that may not have been able to download this yet, they're listening to it on their iPod, because, you know, folks, you can download First Few Moments either at iTunes or at Stitcher.com. Can you just give a brief rundown on what they're talking about?
Sure. Going through the article, of course, it talks about preemptive or preempting traffic signals, which is a common technology that's out there. The only problem with it is when we have multiple vehicles approaching an intersection or multiple response vehicles approaching the same intersection, the right of way sometimes gets confusing. The article also goes on to talk about some developments in mobile applications, whether it's for a BlackBerry or iPod type device, but basically where a dispatch system would send out a tweet or a message to your BlackBerry if you were on the route that an emergency vehicle was taking. I'm not convinced that picking up your BlackBerry and reading a message from the fire department that says, "Hey, meathead, pull over, there's a fire truck behind you," is probably the safest way to go. You know, there's too many distractions for drivers as it is. Do they really need to be getting a message from the fire department saying, "Hey, we're coming up behind you"? So, and then going through, there were some other technological or technology-based solutions. Another one, of course, was a GPS system in the cab of the fire truck that shows a real-time map with real-time vehicle positions so that the driver can see if there are multiple vehicles approaching the same intersection. Again, my argument or my position being, do we really want the driver of a fire truck or other emergency vehicle staring at a computer screen trying to determine whether he's going to get to the intersection first or not? Or do we want him heads up, looking down the road, clearing the intersections the way we were all taught back in the day? So is technology the answer, or should we keep it simple and get back to driver training and drivers paying attention? And if it's not safe, just don't go.
I think that's an excellent point. If I may chime in, I'd like to address a few of those.
Absolutely, go for it.
Good. Thanks, Kyle. The PDA thing, I agree with Steve. I think personally, I think it's a technological solution for a behavioral problem. And the behavioral problem is distractions already out there. We have too many distractions with cell phones, text messaging, GPS, the radio, HD radio, satellite radio, and it just goes on, and people not paying attention to their whereabouts and what's going on around them. The PDA thing, it's, you know, I don't know how yours works, but you're probably going to send me that message and I'll probably get it 3 minutes after the fact. So now my PDA or my phone's going off alerting me to the fire truck that is alongside of me that I should be already aware of. So now it's only another distraction, another confusing issue. And I'm on the same page with Steve that I think that's although it sounds like a nifty little device, I don't think it's practical in its workings. The GPS thing, though, I agree with Steve again on the fact that do we want drivers looking at it? But nine times out of 10, if you're responding to another emergency and you have, you know, in New York, where I'm from, we may have other agencies responding in and we don't know that they're responding because we're on different radio frequencies. So I don't know that police or fire is responding along with EMS to the same incident, and we're going to converge on the same intersection roughly at the same time. I'm not aware of other units responding. Also in New York, where we're so busy, we may have other units converging in on an intersection going to different calls. And usually if you're responding to a call, you have you and your partner or an officer up front, and they could be the ones paying attention to that GPS and alerting the driver that, according to this GPS, we have another unit approaching from that blind spot, you know, to your left or to your right or straight ahead. Does that remove the due diligence and the fact that that driver should already be alert and aware of his surroundings and his driving environment? Absolutely not. That driver has the utmost responsibility. And I don't think anything that's going to change. I think that's the same issue that we have with the Opticon system, in the sense that a lot of our drivers now are relying on the fact that the intersection is going to be clear because the light's turning red for me.
Rob, I have to agree with you with that. And that was one thing that I was going to say, you know, after that, you know, you had mentioned it, is as it is, emergency vehicle drivers assume that they have the right of way through an intersection and that everyone's going to clear out. And I hate to say it, and I really wish Russell was here because I could pick on him a little bit. But, you know, it seems really prevalent with the engineer of, you know, large fire vehicles, that I see them more likely blow through intersections than I do ambulances. Ambulances still do. But, you know, the feeling is I'm big, I'm loud, everyone must hear me, see me, you know, I'm coming through. Now we go ahead and we add on the system to it that is going to automatically clear the intersection for me and give me the right of way. You know, one, what happens if that system fails? And two, like you were saying, what happens if you have other units coming from different directions? You know, we're gearing for a mess.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it just shows. It shows in Houston. It showed in St. Louis, in New York and Brooklyn. It happened where units converge on an intersection and they run into each other. Some of them, I think one of them had the Opticon system in place. A couple of others didn't. But the outcome was still the same. So it's definitely a problem out there. And what's happening is that we're trying to fix a behavioral problem with technological solutions.
You know, and I guess, like reading this, and Steve, you sent this article to me out of government technology. And folks, we will put this up on the website as a link. But I forgot to name it, and you said right there, the Opticon, this is nothing new. This is not new technology. I remember this technology being used. We had this in on the ambulance going back almost 20 years ago. You know, something similar, and it didn't work. We had a lot of issues with it.
That's right. I mean, it has been around for a while, and there have been issues, and there continue to be issues with that technology. And like you said, Kyle, I mean, 20 years we've had Opticon or Opticon type technology. We're still seeing the problem. Is the solution going to be technology, or is it going to be taking the drivers, taking the vehicle operators, and training them back to the basics, clearing an intersection the old-fashioned way where you and your partner sat in the front and you used your eyes and you used your communication skills, and if it wasn't safe to proceed through the intersection, you just didn't. Again, we've all heard it in countless training sessions, come to a stop. If it's safe to proceed, continue through. Is that the practice out there? Probably not everywhere, but maybe it should be, you know, and maybe we need to get back to training rather than our reliance on, you know, the new gizmos and gadgets to make us safer.
You know, I got to kind of agree, but really more likely disagree with what you're talking about, Steve, is it's not just an education thing. I think we've done education. I think it's an affective. I think it's a behavioral change that has to occur on these. I'm just reading the second part of this article that you had sent us, and this is where you're getting into the idea of the messaging and texting aspects. And I'm quoting the article, which is actually a quote. Is that emergency vehicles show up out of nowhere and all of a sudden people get scared to death and try to do the best they can. But by the public not getting out of the way, we're increasing our response times. It's causing a lot of accidents across the United States, many of them fatal. You know, in that phrase right there, increasing our response times. As far as I'm aware of, and I've taken part of informal versions of this, is that lights and sirens is really not that much difference than driving non-lights and sirens, unless you're going for long distances.
Right. Absolutely. That's been proven time and time again.
So here it is we have someone justifying the use of technology, you know, and it's, again, it's putting them into, you have to get out of my way. I have an emergency. And Rob, you always said, siren side, was that, we have... People call it, the siren side is you get, and I'll tell you, I'll be honest, I've felt it. I still, after doing all these years, every once in a while, I just want to get there. And more of it's not the health person, I just want to get there, on that, and that's not a good thing. It's the human factors, and as much training and education as you want to give, these people know that. These people all know what you should be doing. But as soon as you get behind that wheel, it changes. It completely changes. So we have to find a way to change the behavior.
And we have found one of the ways. Unfortunately, it's still within EMS in its infancy, and some of it is it is using new technology, and at the same time, it is somewhat a little bit cost prohibitive for some departments, and that's simulation training. Simulation training works fantastically when it's used appropriately. It's like any other kind of simulation training. We do simulation training in everything, from firefighting to medicine to use of force with the police officers to flight training with all of our pilots.
Rob, but we've had John here quite a bit talking about the simulation training and stuff, and I'm all for it and everything like that. But I'm going to kind of put you on the block here for a few minutes, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
Years ago, in New York State, they used to have something called APPS. And Rob, you're probably familiar with that, Ambulance Accident Prevention Seminar, which is a phenomenal course. The one guy who taught ours was actually a state trooper.
Yes.
I can't remember his name. I mean, just absolutely probably one of the best courses I've taken. There's no, by the way, folks, there's no driving in it. It's all theory. And it really hits the affective domain of learning on that and your emotions. And the one thing that stuck out was he mentioned how they took a 20-year veteran engineer from New York City, drives a fire engine, and took his blood pressure and his pulse driving just normal traffic. Of course, in New York City, it's probably already high. But then they have them turn on the sirens and the lights and drive emergency. And then they took those same vital signs and noticed this veteran, everything increased.
Yeah, with no outward signs.
Right. Now,
the driver appeared to be quite calm and collected and everything else. But his pulse rate and his blood pressure, his respirations all went up.
Right. Now, are you doing that with simulation training? Are you actually measuring? Are you able to? Yes, because these simulators are great. They're really cool. But one, you're really not going to emergency. There's really, if you don't get there, there's really no negative outcome. It's computer graphics.
Right.
Okay. So, I'm all for this, but in terms of changing the affective behavior of these folks, is it really making a difference? Can you actually scientifically show that it's putting them and creating those stressor behaviors on them?
You know, that's a great comment, and my answer to that is yes. We've done a study. In fact, I did a study in New York. Over an 8-year period, it was we measured our intersection collisions 4 years prior to simulation training and then 4 years after simulation training or with simulation training. And what we were able to show over that 8-year period is that in the first year of simulation training, we reduced our intersection collisions by 37%. And we did not change the way we measured our statistics or the way we classified a collision or anything like that. Basically, you hit something, regardless of how minor it is, it's considered a collision. They may classify it in the accident training as a, or the accident recording section as incident, minor, or major, but they're all collisions. To a full blown out frontal collision, you know, with injuries and a totaled out vehicle and so on. They're all measured the same, and that's what we were looking at. Over that 8-year period, from the first 4 years measured against the second 4 years, we reduced our intersection collisions by 50%. We never reduced our overall collision rate because we were having other collisions, other things that we needed to focus on. What I focused in on was the intersection collisions, which are the most devastating, not necessarily the most prevalent. Prior to simulation training, they were 40% of our overall collision rate. After simulation training was introduced and introduced into our total EVOC program, which consisted of lecture and skills, and then simulation, we reduced it down to 20% of our overall collision rate. So yes, you do make a difference with it. And the reason for that is because they do get the lecture information, just like APPS. APPS was a great program. It didn't have any driving involved. You add skills to it, and now you're working on the student's ability to understand the vehicle's dynamics and their spatial relationship to objects around them. But you're still not giving them the understanding and the experience of entering that intersection against a red light left of center with several variables taking place, just like in real life. Most ambulance operators don't learn how to do that until they're responding to their first call. And that's the wrong time to be learning this. And again, simulation is a tool. And if the tool's not used correctly, you're not going to get those kind of results. It requires, just like any other training program, good instructors. And the instructors must make it real. They must have the student understand that what they're doing is legitimate. And you'd be surprised how these students do react. They get sucked into this. They are driving for real. And when they're involved in that collision, it doesn't end there. We have them continue on with the sense that they have to get on the radio. They need to notify dispatch that they've been involved in a collision. And saying it really makes it hit home for them, because the brain works in that aspect of that. When you hear your own self mentioning it, when you're bringing it out verbally, it's now more of a conscious level than just a subconscious level, and it really drives it home with them.
I think what you need to add to it is, if you're in a crash, an airbag full of glass explodes and hits them in the face.
That would be awesome.
I think
that would
be good. William, you're awfully quiet on there. What's your take on this whole technology and driving thing?
Oh, boy. Well, I think that first off, having a text messaging system or some sort of messaging system to be delivered to smartphones says a lot about the current culture. When my 20,000-pound Freightliner ambulance with lots of lights and very loud sirens doesn't catch your attention, but your 4-inch BlackBerry will immediately perk your ears. That says a lot about what it is that we perceive as being necessary. And I'm not faulting anybody for that. I'm a product of this generation. When I walk down the stairs to my apartment building out to my car, if I forget my phone, well, I kind of feel like I've left part of myself up there too. I also don't think that it's going to work, mostly because I know that they are frequently faulty. And the technology just isn't there yet. Now, what was brought up before about the driver of any particular apparatus looking at a map, I know that in looking at a map, looking at GPS, doing whatever in order to see where they're going, I know that at least in my jurisdiction, and I'm sure with many others, the driver at least, is not necessarily looking at the map. They're pretty much watching the road. But at the same time, I don't have the Opticom technology. I don't have anything that's going to help clear the intersection for me. We still rely on you know, good old-fashioned stopping and looking. And I'm definitely, when I'm driving the apparatus, I'm very liberal with the air horn and very liberal with my sirens to let everybody know that, no, I'm right behind you, or I'm right in the intersection and you should see me and hear me, and I'll, you know, wave at stuff and people and make sure they know where it is they need to go. But I also work in a busy jurisdiction. I'm responding outside of West Baltimore. So I've frequently run into intersections where I've got Baltimore County, Baltimore City, and my ambulance all responding to the same intersection, hitting it at the same time. So I do know that's certainly a problem, but at the same time, I kind of look at the other drivers and say, well, have your eyes open and look around. I know it's not that simple. I know that it's not, definitely not that simple, but at the same time, I think that too many of us become complacent when driving, and that maybe not education, but clinical application of theories presented in class might be the problem. When it comes to the technology, being presented as in having GPS maps, or otherwise, I know that in many cases I've used, both the GPS for my cell phone as well as my GPS device for my car to help get me to scenes. Because frequently our ADC, with as fast as some of the areas that have been responding and have been growing, our ADC maps or our map books that have been designed for use in the ambulance aren't being updated. But I can almost guarantee that the CAD system within my mobile computer certainly will not have what I need. So I think that when it comes down to response times and the drivers, it really relies upon common sense and being smart about the way that you're driving and recognizing that you have a lot of responsibility being behind the wheel, not just when you drive your personal car and there's an ambulance behind you, but when you drive the ambulance itself and you're driving the apparatus, you need to keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, keep your head on that swivel and constantly check your mirrors and look, you know, left, right, and center to know what's coming at you. I should be able to look at you, you should close your eyes and you can tell me what color the cars are in front of you and how many there are and where they are in the intersection or in line in front of you and what your best pathway is through it, as well as alternatives. But maybe I'm expecting too much.
Yeah, you are. But you're not. The truth is that the vehicle operator remains ultimately responsible for the vehicle when it's in motion. So it only makes sense that as the operator, you're going to want to keep your head on a swivel, like you said, looking everywhere, knowing what's around you. I can remember once being told by a driving instructor to treat traffic like it was out to get you. And that was look at every possible car and every possible movement of a vehicle out there on the roadway and quickly determine what threat that posed to you and in you getting from point A to point B. And I still to this day quite often will see some sort of maneuver or movement from another vehicle and react to it and respond to it. There's something that technology just isn't going to be able to do for the driver of an emergency vehicle, and that's replace that common sense and that instant communication from eyeball to brain. So keeping the head up and keeping it moving around is key. I remember also just sitting here going over things, but one of the first things we all learned probably day one of our first EMT class was do no harm, and we assumed that meant, you know, do no harm to our patient, but that meant do no harm to the community, do no harm to our partner, do no harm to the equipment we've been entrusted with. So maybe we need to expand upon that do no harm and transfer that thought process into how we operate the vehicles.
You know, I think the other thing, Stephen, basically what you're saying and what everyone's saying, and basically I'm repeating myself from an earlier podcast, is it comes down to situational awareness, folks. You need to almost take the same approach that the helicopter pilots do. is that you're constantly looking around. It's a sterile cockpit, so turn off that AM/FM radio. Turn off the CD player. It's not time to be sitting there, you know, playing Back in Black as you're going to the cardiac arrest. It's cool. It's fun. It gets you pumped up, but it's really going to be an unsafe thing. Get your head out of the computer. I know we all do this with today's computers. And electronic PCRs will go ahead and will start to actually enter in information on the way to the calls into the computer. Well, when you're doing that, you're not looking around. You're not up. You're not scanning the upcoming intersections and driveways. It's not, folks, it's just not the driver's responsibility to do that. It's everybody in that vehicle to be looking around. Same thing with the helicopter. Everybody in that helicopter has an area to look at, and you should be doing the same thing. As you're in that ambulance, driving or not, it's a team approach. You have to be aware of those. I'm also wondering if some of this has to do with sirens. Is that, not in terms of the responders, but in terms of society. If you think about it, in some areas, you hear nothing but sirens, and you start to actually, after a while, just tune out sirens. You're not aware of them being there. And in fact, I'm wondering if that's kind of one of the problems. Even on the radio, you hear sirens on radios and in songs now. So I'm wondering if we just kind of the age of the siren has been shot, you know, up. And, you know, William, you actually brought up something, you know, in our pre-show discussion. I'm going to let you go ahead and take it from here.
Oh, it's been a while. I'm sorry. I have to remind me what it is that I brought up for you.
The alternative siren.
Go ahead. Oh, yes, of course. The rumbler.
You'll go ahead and get used to my segues into things. That's okay.
It's all right. The Federal Signals rumbler, in addition to all the other great sirens from their wail and their yelp and their infamous Hilo, they also now have the rumbler, which is the ultra-low frequency subwoofer type siren, which you can apply to your various emergency vehicles. And, you know, honestly, I had seen it at trade shows. I'd seen it at conferences. I thought it was really cool. It was awesome. It was, you could turn it on and, you know, make your bowels shake. But I had never seen it in use until one day I was sitting at an intersection and a police cruiser pulled up behind me with its lights on and its siren. And like you said, I sort of tuned it out and pulled over to the side. And it wasn't until they hit the rumbler. And now, mind you, I was parked next to or was at the intersection next to a car that had the bass going. So I was used to that really loud thumping and I could feel my car vibrating. And then I hear that, you know, really low, I mean, incredibly low, think Alpenhorn low rumble. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound like the bass. And then there was the cop car. And then I thought, that's really cool. And it wasn't until I came back and then looked at it and realized that he must have had the rumbler that was making the noise. And that was kind of cool. I don't know. I've only ever experienced it that one time, so I'm not sure. I think if I had one on my apparatus, I could tell you how effective it is. I do know that it is really freaking cool. I was definitely shocked by it. Sort of like the first time you hear an air siren, that the first time you hear a real cue. That first time you get that wind up, it's very cool. I liked it a lot. Like I said, I can't speak for the actual effectiveness of it, but definitely a cool toy.
Well, if I may get in on that, I have to say that I've seen the rumbler used several times, and personally, I think it's quite effective. It doesn't replace your other siren. It actually works in conjunction with your regular siren, and you're able to use it as both wail or yelp, and it just adds that bass tone to it that basically vibrates other cars around you. So now if you're not hearing the siren, you're noticing that all of a sudden your rearview mirror is shaking, which kind of like clues you into something. You look up and next thing you know, there's that police car next to you or whatever. So it does help in that regard. You know, frequencies travel at different speeds and different distances, you know, based on the frequency. And bass helps to travel a little, you know, it doesn't travel as far, but it does work quite effectively in a short range area. While our sirens are usually working well in distance, a long distance, but the problem is that they get lost in the congestion of traffic and buildings and that such. So that adds to the problem as well. Kyle, what I'd like to do, I'd like to get back to an issue on training later if we can.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. I don't know if you want to touch on it now or we could go.
No, go ahead.
Okay. We were talking about training and we talked about simulation. And you're absolutely right in the sense that you said what we need to do is start changing the behavior. And I don't think the training that we currently do is actually doing that. And we have several reasons. One is that we don't have a standard EVOC program or driving program across this country, across North America, or anywhere else. We have standards to become an EMT. We have standards to become a paramedic. Nobody can become an EMT or a paramedic without completing a certain amount of curriculum and a certain number of hours and being trained by a certified instructor. We have nothing of that sort when it comes to EVOC, and that's a problem. And that's where we need to start working more as an EMS community in getting it through our associations and our members, state REMSCOs and regional areas, and saying that we need this curriculum and we need to have it developed and it needs to be implemented. When you can have anybody teach anywhere from a 4-hour to a 52-hour long EVOC program, and you're certifying them, I don't see where there's a standard. That's why we're always going to have collisions. When you're having people who don't truly really believe in what they're training and they're not getting that across, that becomes an issue as well.
And those are definitely things to look at. But I mean, like, what do you suggest? I mean, should this go to the national level? Should this be a state requirement? I mean, well, I know in Pennsylvania, you actually have to go through a driver training program approved by the state before you can even step, foot behind the steering wheel of an emergency vehicle. And it seems kind of, some states do, some states don't. But it's kind of funny because you hear about Pennsylvania in the news all the time with accidents.
Right. So, again, how effective is it? And you mentioned about our APPS program and what a great program it was. And it was a very good program, not to take away from it. But did it really do its job in helping reduce collisions? And it really didn't. The unfortunate thing about it is that not much has changed. Not much has changed at all. It's still the number one killer in EMS personnel. You pointed out the fact that it's 2 times higher than the national average for motor vehicle collisions and fatalities. And we're doing a disservice to all of our members. The reason why I love EVOC so much is because it was the one thing that I was able to do to really help protect our members. And no other training does that. The problem that we have, though, again, is that there's no real curriculum, and there's not enough scientific data behind any of it. We found out that simulation training does work, and I know this isn't the forum for everything about simulation training, but I just want to put it across that when it's added as a third component to your already existing EVOC program, it can't be a standalone issue. Simulation training just won't fill the whole bill. You have to have didactic, you have to have skills, but the simulation training helps to tie it all together. Because when you show in a lecture other people's accidents, other people's collisions, other people's mistakes, and the ramifications they had to deal with, most of our young students are looking at it saying, well, that's not me. That's not going to happen to me. And when you put them into simulation training and they have the collision there, it's now happening to them. And yeah, it is simulation, but you'd be surprised. It does work. It's just like when you're working that simulated code and your instructor's telling you you're losing that patient. You still feel something. It's still working. It requires you to start to develop pathways and muscle memory that helps you to coordinate and starts to develop a recognition primed response. So that way you'll see this occur again and you'll know what to do.
But to do the muscle memory, Rob, is you're going to have repetitive time on the simulator. I mean, to really adequately develop muscle memory on that. And so how is that really going to be possible?
Well, it depends on your program. Some programs are able to do repetitive simulation training. Some are not. But the one thing that you can do is we call it a recognition primed. Decision making, RPDM. All right. And what's happening there is basically what we're saying is that you do things well because of experience. And what happens is that experience creates these recognition patterns in your brain. So that way, when you're running that arrest or you're running the fire and you're on the scene of something, you don't have to sit and analyze all the problems, all the things that are going on to formulate a conclusion. You're looking at it, and you don't even know that you're doing it, the recognition-primed decision-making is happening because of previous experiences. So if we could give people the previous experience in the simulator, because you're creating real-world situations, because you're able to write your own scenarios, and so when you had a collision that occurred in your department, you could recreate that. Or if you had near misses in your own personal experience, you could recreate that for other students and give them real things.
Now, Robert, the question I'm going to ask you on that is most of these services that have simulation are going to be the large urban departments, correct?
No, actually, that's not true. We have quite a few. There's a lot of departments out there.
But to actually get the muscle memory, to actually do that repetitive training, are these small departments doing that?
Well, if you're not doing it on muscle memory training, like you said, then you could do it on RPDM, recognition prime decision making.
Because, I mean, I guess my question is, I think, now, I haven't actually pulled any statistics, haven't looked at anything. I'm just going anecdotally off of the news feeds that we have. But it seems like a lot of these accidents are in rural areas. These fatal accidents are in rural areas, rural roads.
Right.
On that, which typically is volunteer-based. Not, again, folks, I'm not saying the volunteers because I don't have any information on me. I'm just going by what I've been reading and seeing. But it seems to be a common thing. So, that's the problem that we were having is you have people, even young, kids. I know here in the city of Buffalo, I've been bred for failure because they've never been put into an emergency vehicle before, let alone really drive for a long period of time. And then they're taken right from EMT, put onto a paramedic ambulance, told to drive, right to the,
to the scene.
To the scene, and they're crashing.
Right. Because another reason why that's happening is because we're failing to train them appropriately when they're behind the wheel. Because when you're behind the wheel, like you were saying, Kyle, is that your head isn't in the game. Your head is someplace else. And where that someplace else is on the call. You have already put yourself on scene, even though you're still several blocks away, several intersections away. You and your partner are sitting there saying, all right, well, the way this call is coming in, you're going to grab the tube, I'm going to grab the line, we're going to do this, we'll manage that. Who's going to get the paperwork? Who's going to get this? I'll grab this equipment. And so on. Your head is already at the scene, and you haven't even cleared your third intersection. And that's the problem. We have to leave our heads right where we are, in that intersection. And the problem is again, something else that we've identified is, I think it was William that said, or maybe Steve, about that your head has to be on a swivel. You have to check everything. I am of the old school, but I'm with new technology, the old school that you have to use your eyes and ears and your brain. You have to look at everything. You can't rely on technology. You can't rely on the Opticom. the GPS or the PDA. But the problem that we have with our new kids is that a lot of these students are driving, and they've been driving. They've got their license now for three years, maybe four years, if we're lucky. Some of them only a couple of years. But they've been driving for 8 or 9 years on Nintendo and Xbox, driving Grand Theft Auto and everything else. And all their heads are looking at one screen. And they don't have to learn, and they don't have to recognize peripheral vision or swivel their heads around. And we're recognizing that. We're actually seeing students in the simulator who are not checking their blind spots, who are not checking their mirrors. You know, you could do that on a skills course to a point, but when you put them into a real-world situation, and now you have a vehicle alongside of you in their blind spot that they're not identifying, we're able to identify the problem and correct it sooner so that hopefully we fix it before they get out on the road. When we're approaching an intersection and in the simulator and we recognize that they're not recognizing their blind spot or the fact that the siren's not penetrating through because of buildings, we're able to now critique and work with them on that. And when they're involved in a collision, and we go through the ramifications of that, we've had people that were shaking. We've had people that, oh my God, they cannot believe what they did. Yeah, at first they giggled, uh-oh, I've been involved in a collision. But when we really break it down for them and explain all the ramifications that take place that they did because of their split-second decision that they made right there, not that somebody else that we're talking about anecdotally, it's what they just did, that really hits home with them. That's why you have a decrease in intersection collisions. It does work if you use it properly, like anything else.
Now, if you guys don't mind me kind of heading off on my own little personal tangent here, we've talked about the safety and clearing intersections, and what about those? I mean, collisions are going to occur. All of the training, all of the technology, everything's put in place. Collisions are still going to occur. I struggle with the fact that we're still not requiring crew members to wear helmets. We know that head injury is one of the leading causes of death for EMS providers in the patient care compartment. Why is it that helmets seem like an absolutely foreign concept in this industry?
Can you tell me anybody else who wears a helmet, other than a firefighter, who's wearing his helmet only because he's already dressed to operate at the scene? Who else is wearing a helmet?
Flight medics.
NASCAR drivers.
Who are in vehicles, not flight medics.
Well, it's a vehicle. What's a helicopter?
NASCAR.
Again, in our situation, NASCAR, you talk about a sport.
Yeah, you are. But I mean, if we look
about
at
256 miles an hour, we're not talking about 30 miles, 40 miles an hour.
Sometimes it feels like 256.
It does, but especially if you have the wrong driver behind the wheel.
And especially if there's a collision. But whether other departments are doing it or not, is there a reason why we wouldn't? We're looking at head injury being a leading cause of death. Why isn't some protection for the head not warranted? I know very few departments have made the policy, but Kyle and I were actually talking prior to the recording tonight. Remember back the old days when Johnny and Roy used to respond in Squad 51 with their helmets on? Like back in the 70s, if for some reason it seemed like a good idea to Hollywood. Maybe this is something we should look at. Doesn't it make sense that some sort of head protection be worn if we're operating the vehicle in a manner that puts us at a higher level of risk, responding with lights and sirens or performing patient care in the back of the vehicle? And I know a lot of departments say that you must be restrained now, but we all know that effective restraint for a paramedic in the back of the truck is difficult to achieve. Maybe a helmet reduces some of the injuries and some of the fatalities.
Well, going on the aspect I was talking about earlier, Rob, you're saying, well, the helicopters, you know, that helmets are actually a fairly new thing, the helicopters. That's not it's not something that's been going on since the invention of them. The reason why they started to wear them is because of head strikes and injuries that were preventable. And the injury level could have been, the morbidity could have been reduced if they would have been wearing a helmet. And you look at a lot of these fatalities that are in ambulances, and what is it? It's a head-induced injury. It's a traumatic brain injury. It's a oxygen tank to the head. It's a fall forward. I mean, now mind you, that a use of a helmet is only a small drop in the big bucket for what has to happen. But, you know, we need to start changing things. And I think helmet is one of the first things. And think about it. I miss my flight helmet. I got to tell you, I miss it for a lot of reasons. One, you know, I could talk to somebody. You know, my whole communication was in the helmet. Two, I had something called a lip light. I loved it. This little light right down there that it could be dark out and I could look and see everything, you know, and close up. I didn't have to hold a little flashlight in my hand on it, which is great when you're out, you know, in a car or something like that. But, you know, helmets, I think we should start looking at that. We need to find some sort of a design, not just, ooh, this is cool. They need to be a designed helmet for what we do. On that fire helmets, you know, are not appropriate for what we do. We need to find something else. And that's what we need to look at. So, yeah, I think we definitely need to have helmets, Rob.
Okay. Kyle, I'm not against the helmet theory. Because anything out there to protect, I mean, that would be like saying I'm against seatbelts, which just is not true. I'm not against the helmet issue, but again, that's not fixing the problem. That's, well, hopefully it will prevent an injury, but we're not preventing the collision. And yes, not every collision is going to be avoidable. But we need, where, if you look at the collisions that are going on right now, there, a lot of them are preventable, and a lot of them are just simple, small mistakes that have turned into catastrophes. And we need to work on the training issues of that. Like I said before, I'm not against the helmets. I'm all for it as well, if it will help save a life and prevent an injury or a death. But I'm looking at trying to prevent the collision to begin with.
Absolutely. The same argument. You brought up a great point with seatbelts, right? We wear a seatbelt with the hope that we never, ever have to use it or rely upon it. But the truth is, we would all like to avoid these situations. The original, I guess, kind of topic we were on tonight was, can technology help us do that? Yeah, there's probably some things out there that technology can improve. But it comes back down to that vehicle operator.
You know, I think, Steve, just for a minute, going on that technology, NIOSH just continues research, and we'll put this article out there about, you know, ambulance service workers and EMS responders, which is what I was quoting earlier about the number of fatalities that we're having. And I think that technology is important. I think we're starting to see some of it leak over into our industry. We're bringing in engineers. When I was over in Fulda, Germany at Retmobile, the technology that's over there is amazing, and the safety. And I'm looking at this picture, you know, courtesy of NIOSH with these test dummies, and, you know, it's showing the back of an ambulance. They have a person on the stretcher, a person in the captain's seat. They have two persons on the bench seat. And then they have that, you know, nice, that little mesh thing at the end of the bench seat, you know, that you have is supposed to protect you. First of all, that rips right out of the ceiling. But the biggest problem we have is tradition. And going back to all of it, why do we still wear the good old New Yorker style fire helmet? Tradition. It's not a good helmet.
The European helmet's probably one of the best helmets out there.
Exactly. It is efficient. It's effective. It's more protective. But we don't do it because of tradition.
It doesn't look like a fire helmet.
Exactly. And when I was over in Germany, Ronald from Oslo, Norway, we were riding around in his ambulance, and I asked him, I said, when did you guys get rid of your bench seat? Because all they had was one forward-facing seat. He goes, oh, back in 1960s, 1970s. So they haven't had them in over 30, 40 years. And here it is. We still try to make them. We know what the problem is. We know head strikes. You look at a lot of these ambulance manufacturers, and they say, well, it's improved safety. We've rounded the corners. Yeah, but your head traveling at 50 miles an hour into that corner, that just real round piece of plastic is not going to help you. That mesh at the end of the bench seat is not going to help you. You know, none of the stuff. It's not proven. It's not crash tested. They just look at it and say, yeah, this should work. This may be good. But it's not. If you look at when I had my accident, it was the captain's seat. I'm sitting, you know, facing backwards, but it was a lateral collision, and that shelf that's right there, right at chest level, went right into my ribs. Luckily, I had a ballistic vest on, and it took the absorbed most of the impact and just gave me bruised ribs as opposed to broken ribs. But we need to change the design of our ambulances. I'm trying to get Chris Fitzgerald on here, who works a lot with the EMS Safety Foundation with Nadine Levick, and I think we're going to actually have a whole episode on ambulance design coming up. But, you know, this is just something we need to look at. We need to start changing things. Get away from these huge, monstrous Type 3 ambulances because you can put everything in there. No. Get smaller.
All right. Yeah, I agree. And that's the problem that we're having with our ambulance manufacturers, that there's, you know, it comes down to the dollars again. And there's no real standard. There's no standards for crash tests or the standards of anything 18 inches behind the driver. They're just starting to change things now. We're getting away from the standards that we have now, the recommendations, and they're actually going with NFPA standards. I mean, it's about time that they finally started doing that.
William, go ahead. You've been quiet.
Oh, yeah, no, it's fine. I just, you guys touched on a topic that I was hoping that would come up, which was ambulance design. That's actually something I've been very interested in for quite a long time now, because I've worked in everything from the typical ambulance to the van front modular back, the truck front modular back, the big international freightliner, the giant Type 3, or the Sprinter type ones. You know, and honestly, the question I ask anybody who is a strong supporter of the Freightliner-sized ambulance, which is, how many times have you ever needed that much space inside your ambulance ever? And generally the answer is, well, there was that one time I put those two guys on backboards, and then usually that's, you know, we can solve that problem a many, many different ways. I was at the State Firemen's Convention here in Maryland over the summer, and met up with some guys from Diamond State Ambulance. They were pushed. They were in a booth that was pushed to the way back of the convention hall. They were didn't really get a lot of publicity. They had three or four ambulances there. They're doing some very intriguing things with interior design. One of the things that I talked to them about was, why do we have to have a box designed to carry patients? Why not design a vehicle to carry patients? There's absolutely no reason for air ride suspension to be pumped all the way up so that you can deliver the highest ride height. I know it's a lot of tradition. I know it's gotta look comparable when it's next to, you know, truck five in the bay. But it really isn't. There's no clinical need for it. And in Maryland, as Kyle and I discussed in the past, is very much fire based, which means that breaking free of that tradition is difficult. One of the designs that Diamond State had, which I was a huge fan of, which was actually an Isuzu cab flat, it was a cab over design with a short wheelbase and a short box that allowed for you to you didn't have to stand up. The way that it was designed, you still had enough room for two backboards in order to house the two patients, but the paramedic had drawers and had a five-point harness so that you didn't have to actually get up to treat your patient. You could do everything you needed to do from the bench seat, and did it in a way which kept you from being displaced at all. And like you said before, the rounded corners of the cabinets don't do anything except give you a rounded depressed skull fracture. I've been involved in a couple minor accidents, but have been involved in many, 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 many more close calls. In fact, due to current ambulance design, actually having to get up and pick things out of cabinets in order to run a call when you're working, and having my driver really quickly swerve in traffic, and I put my head through more cabinets than I care to count. So I've taken my fair share of beatings. I don't know that necessarily helmet design. It's you're going to meet a lot of resistance from field providers wanting to wear helmets in the back. I certainly sympathize with the communications. I think that the couple times that I've ridden an ambulance that have had headsets, it's been phenomenal. Being able to do a consult with a headset and not have to actually take my hands off the patient was worth every second of riding there and having it on. I would be for a helmet if we could find a way to make it so that I'm not – it doesn't feel like I'm wearing a bike helmet and I'm not having to wear something as cumbersome as, say, a Sam Houston leather. So find a nice happy medium that's both safe and effective, and I'll jump right along.
I agree with you. I mean, it's got to be something usable and effective. And when I was over in Germany, I actually found a couple that would have really done well. Of course, everybody, I think, Dragar or any of the European styles. Unfortunately, they're not approved here in the United States by NFPA. But they are very effective helmets. They're low profile. They fit right down around the head. With this strapping and ratchet system, and they were comfortable, and we need to start looking at that. You go back to the ambulances, and you go every other type of ambulance that's out there, whether it be a type 1 box, a type 2 van or type 3, box van front, is the problem with those is if you're not aware of, the only thing that has to pass the safety standard is the chassis. So when they have a van front, the only thing that passes is that van. There's no safety measures on those boxes. There's no standards for it. And that's one of the biggest problems that we're having. And you see some of these ambulance manufacturers where they'll demonstrate our box is strong. They take it and they have it sitting on its top. Well, they just took it and flipped it over. Yeah, it's going to work fine. But most of those, if you've ever seen how they're constructed, they're terrible. They're just some aluminum beams. That's about it, and they're going to absolutely crumble when they're struck. Probably the next best thing is the van. On that. Get away from the boxes, get the van. But really, going to these these Sprinter type ambulances, the unibody is what they're looking at. The whole unibody, because that whole body has been constructed, has been crash tested, and meets all standards for safety on that.
I think that you're absolutely correct, and I do really like the way the module looks. I think it's one of the things that I'm sure draws everybody to EMS or fire rescue in general is, wow, that's really pretty. That looks good. It's the same reason I like my G-Extreme gear and a leather helmet. It looks good. It's not by any means appropriate. I think that the module system could work if we find a way to improve the mounting hardware or include the module system as part of a unibody and then just change the design of the entire vehicle. No one says that it has to be a chassis which can be interchangeable from a box truck to an ambulance to a horse trailer.
But the thing
is, the fact that we get lumped into that.
Right, but the thing is with the boxes, structurally, they have not found a way to make those sound without making them too heavy on that. And that's why you go to like the European style ambulances, like what Oslo, Norway has, that we showed in the EMS Safety Foundation. It's all one piece. The frame goes all the way through. So it's not just, it's not just the shearing, but if you ever look at any of these images of these vehicles that have boxes, no matter what style, 1 or 3, when they hit a tree, they just crumble. There's nothing left. Or if they roll over more than once, there's nothing left. They just absolutely disintegrate.
They do. And again, Kyle, the whole issue is that, talking about the boxes and about chassis is that, unfortunately, it's not EMCs and paramedics who are buying the ambulances. We're the ones using it. The ones buying them are the fleet managers. And as far as they're concerned, a box ambulance is great because when it's involved in a collision, because as far as they're concerned, it will be, I could take the box off of one and put it on a new chassis. I could salvage things. I could cannibalize a vehicle and put them on different things. And unfortunately, we're the ones stuck with this. The triple K specs don't meet up to standards anymore. It never has. I mean, if you look at it, the Triple K specs, they'll spend 5 pages talking about lighting. Patient lighting, interior lighting, emergency lighting, and so on. But it isn't until you get to like page, I think page 45, that they actually have a section on the protection of patients and crew. And you know how long that is? 2.5 lines. It talks about the upholstered padding and cushioning that should provide an upper protection on doorways. Are you serious? That's what the Triple K specs write about as far as protection for crew members and patients? 5 pages on lighting, 7 pages on paints and design, and 2.5 lines on protection of patients and crew. This is why, again, until we start getting legislation involved in changing what the manufacturers have to do and start developing vehicles that have to meet IIHS and NHTSA standards, not just the cab, but the whole vehicle, then we're in trouble. And the only thing that's going to protect us are ourselves. And that's by training our drivers to be better drivers. I agree with everything that we're talking about. We need to have more technology helping us in certain cases. Helmets work in certain cases, just like airbags and seatbelts. But we need to work on preventing the collisions. Because if vehicles aren't collision worthy, and we don't have the proper gear or anything else to prevent our injuries in these collisions. And the simplest and cheapest thing is the training. That's what we really need to get down to. We need to get these kids to rein back. And I'm sorry, I don't mean kids, but we need to get them to rein back and slow down.
I was going
to
say, I think one of the last accidents I saw, they were 42 and 53, I think.
Where and one was 58.
Yeah.
And one was 58, yeah. So, you know, I don't mean kids, but I mean, we're it's everything. It's ambulances, it's pumpers, they're tenders. We're smashing up everything.
It's training. It's behavioral. One of the other leading causes of crashes we can look at is fatigue. Whether you're in an urban department and you're running a lot of calls and 12 hours into the shift you're getting tired, or you're a volunteer in a rural area, you've worked all day on the farm or at your job, and then you get a 2:30 in the morning call with a 45-minute transport somewhere, fatigue becomes an issue as well. So we need to change a lot of around the mindset of operating a vehicle and operating it safely. And ultimately, it still comes down to the driver has to be responsible for the driver's actions. And the passenger, it wouldn't hurt if the passenger and the driver had that kind of a rapport where a passenger could look over and say, hey, you know what, you just kind of committed a little bit of a violation there, and since this is my life you're endangering, I don't really appreciate it. So maybe we need that communication amongst the crew, kind of a self-check. Hey, you tell me how I'm driving, I'll tell you how you're driving. And nobody likes to have their driving criticized. We all think we're the best driver out there. But the truth is, communication, taking that responsibility, understanding when you sit in that seat on the left side of the truck and you got the big wheel in front of you, you are ultimately responsible for everybody in your vehicle and everybody around your vehicle. That's a pretty big responsibility. William, you said earlier, it's the most dangerous thing we do every day. Why?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
It is. It's you know, everything else that we do doesn't matter. It's the one thing that is consistent from police officers to engine drivers to ambulance personnel to just civilians. We all do it, and it blows my mind that people do it without remaining conscious of what's around them. It really, and you saw my frustration earlier, it absolutely boggles my mind that people would drive inattentively. And I don't know.
William, I agree with you, because it's just complacency throughout the whole driving aspect. when you're 15 or 16 years old and all you have to do is take a 20-question test and get 16 of them right to get your permit, and then you take a 3-minute road test later on to get your license so that you could drive as, you know, as a teenager, and then nobody ever, ever evaluates you again, and you could be 90-something years old still driving out on the roads, and the last time you were evaluated when you were 15 or 16 going for your permit. That's a problem. Then when the states don't require you to have a special license in EVOC, I mean, there's just a few states out in our nation that require that to be able to operate an ambulance. You must have a state ambulance license. But outside of that, most of us are able to drive with nothing more than that license we got when we were a teenager. And the problem that we have is the complacency, both in society and in our organizations. And I think one of the big issues is that as drivers, we tend to overestimate our abilities and underestimate the task at hand. And that usually leads us into making a minor mistake that turns into a major collision.
That's well said.
I think that that said is also very well said. And one more thing to follow up to injury prevention instead of just driving tactics or design of the ambulances. This is something that's been very important to me, and actually was one of the things that I got to I was discussing with Justin Shore, the Happy Medic, not too long ago, which is wear your seatbelt. Why is it that you read about these line of duty deaths that occur from vehicle incidents, and it comes out that they weren't wearing their seatbelt? Why? If you're responding to an incident. It's and it literally is. If I jump in my car to grab something from the glove compartment, I will, without even thinking, grab the seatbelt. Not because, oh God, I might get an accident parked here in the street, but it's just such an instinct to hop in a vehicle and put on my seatbelt. And I work on a private campus with no real roadway. It's more of just roads connecting various parking lots. I still wear my seatbelt to the call. It takes me 2 minutes to respond, and I still put my seatbelt on because, you know what? It's just what I do. It's important. There's a reason that it's there. It's the same reason that there's airbags there. You know, it's the, one of the easiest things you can do. There's no excuse for you not to put it on.
Okay.
And I've yelled at plenty of my drivers about it.
And then that's a great point there on that. But we have to wrap up. We are just hitting probably just a little over an hour right now on that, and it came into a great discussion for us. And I think we're going to probably continue this hopefully on to the next episode on that. So as we just wrap up here real quick, William, why don't you go ahead and tell us where we can find you?
Sure, yeah. You can find me on Twitter at WMRandomWard. You can also find me at my blog, which is www.randommedic.com. It's hosted underneath the First Responders Blog Network. Those are my two best places. You can find all my other contact information via the blog.
Great. Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Kyle.
Robert, where can we find you?
Well, thank you, Kyle, for having me on. This was a great discussion. You can find me on Twitter at @first_safety. And also you could feel free to email me at rob@faac.com. And also check out the website, www.faac.com.
Ashton, thank you so much for joining us. As always, it's always great to get that side of things. So thank you. And last but not least, Mr. Steve Murphy. Steve, where can we find you?
All right, any one of three places. If you want to email me, you can get me at smurphy@firstfewmoments.com. You can find me on Facebook if you want to look for me. And if you happen to have an inkling, you usually find me on some trout stream somewhere casting a fly line. Good luck with that one. But thanks for having me, guys. It was a fun discussion tonight.
Well, thank you, Steve. And you can find me, of course, here at the podcast at firstfewmoments.com. You can find me at Kyle David Bates at firstfewmoments.com, over on Twitter at firstfewmoments. You can also find me on Twitter at ImageMedic, KyleDavidBates.com. And please, hey, go over to PDU, PEDI-U.com. That site is growing quite rapidly with Dr. Lou Romig and Dr. Peter Antevi and all the folks that help us out with that, talking about everything pediatric wise. We just put up a episode on pediatric chest pain, so check that one out. Also check out our Facebook page, because that's growing as well. So folks, you know, just, you know, we'd love to have your comments. Give us a call on the First Few Moments hotline, 716-245-5FFM. Leave a message. You never know, it may show up online. We may actually call you to talk to you about some stuff. So your comments are always welcome. So remember, just remember, the whole the core concept of First Few Moments is safety, management, triage, and care. And always, 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 if any of those three, remember the safety aspect. Thank you, and have a good night.